very grateful to be here. I love the Friendship Club. I love the Primary Purpose Group. You guys have been a foundation of my recovery since the day I came in on that Sunday morning in December of 2005. Was I powerless? Was I powerless back in 2005? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. My drinking career started long before I actually had my very first drink, if that makes sense to you. I had all of the isms, all of the behaviors of an alcoholic as a very, very young child. I had that big inferiority complex. I had that big ego. I had that low self-esteem. You know, there was always somebody in my circle that I wanted to be like. I wanted what they had. You know, there was this kid I grew up with. His name was Calvin. I was always a tall kid. Calvin was a short little guy, but he was a hell of a baseball player, and he was better at baseball than I was. So, you know, I looked up to Calvin, even though I had to look down to Calvin. You know, when it came to girls, I had no game whatsoever. I was shy. I was intimidated. My dad was an alcoholic, so I saw what an alcoholic looked like. I came from a very, very dysfunctional family. When at a young age, your mother turns to you and says, you're not as good looking as your brother and you're not as smart as your brother, so you're going to have to work twice as hard in order for you to get ahead. That kind of like sets a great foundation in my mind and my soul and my spirit to say I am less than. So, how did I overcome that? Well, at 12 years old, growing up in a very, very traditional Jewish family, we attend what's called bar and bat mitzvahs. It's a transition from boyhood to manhood, girlhood to womanhood. And there's usually a religious ceremony that precedes a large celebration and meal. At the large celebration and meals, there is alcohol. And I discovered my magic elixir. My magic elixir were whiskey sours. Now, what is a whiskey sour? A whiskey sour tastes like Tang, which was the juice that astronauts used to drink. It's, you know, a nice little sour drink. It has fruit in it. And I found that when I drank a whiskey sour, and it was always cute for the bartender. Ah, look at the little kid. He wants to have a drink. Give him another one. You know, to a 12-year-old kid getting sauced, you know, it's pretty entertaining for most. Little did I realize that it was my magic elixir. When I drank whiskey sours, suddenly I could dance like I've never danced before. I could sing like I never sang before. And suddenly I had the willingness to go up to the prettiest girl in the room and ask her if she would dance with me. I found my higher power. At 12 years old, I found my higher power. My higher power was alcohol. It's amazing because all of a sudden I felt good. All of the things that I felt bad about went away. They all went away. All of the things that I was powerless over, I suddenly became powerful over. It was amazing. And trust me when I tell you, it didn't get better. It did not get better for the next 30 years. It escalated from there because alcohol turned into drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol turned into lying, cheating, stealing, doing whatever I have to do to get what I want. Remember the old adage, I want what you have and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. That was the underlying theme of my life. If you came into a bar with a beautiful woman, I would want what you have, and I am willing to do anything to get what you have. All right? This was my MO. This was exactly how I grew up. This is how I lived my life. If you had the job that made you a lot of money, I would morph into whatever was necessary to become eligible to have that job so that I could have as much money as you had. If you were a good-looking girl and you had an English accent, suddenly I developed an English accent. If you were Latin, I became Latin. If you were French, I became French. Because I was willing to go to any length to get what you had. And yes, brothers, when I tell you it became unmanageable, it absolutely became unmanageable. You know, so we fast forward, where was I 6 months before I came to my first AA meeting? I love telling the story about Wendy's wedding, and for some of you who've heard my story before, you know the story of Wendy's wedding. Wendy and Phil got married on Thanksgiving, and we know that Thanksgiving is the end of November of 2005. It was a house wedding, and there were about 125 people there. They tell me there was actually a ceremony that went on before the actual wedding, before the party afterwards. I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever of a ceremony. None. They tell me she walked down the aisle. I don't remember her walking down the aisle. They said he walked down the aisle. No recollection. He said, I do. She said, I do. They put on rings. They kissed. They walked in. Now my memory kicks in. Because here's what happened. At the reception, everybody lined up outside the door, and they were given those large plastic solo cups. You know those red and blue solo cups? Okay. So I was handed a solo cup, because that was my ticket to get to the bar, all right? And who do you think was first in line to get to the bar in front of 125 guests? You're damn right. And what did the bartender do? He put way too much ice in my cup. Way too much ice in my cup. It's a waste of space, right? Who needs ice? I just needed vodka, all right? So he fills my cup with vodka. I get back on the back of the line because I figure by the time I'm done draining this first one, I'll be ready for another one. I get back to the bar, and the bartender looks at me. He's like, you're back again? And I look at him quizzically because was it my stellar good looks? Was it my charming personality? Or was he just absolutely blown away that I could suck down that cup of vodka so quickly and get another one in that much time? So certain things happened on that night that I'm not really proud of, but I share because it's indicative of the insanity of my alcoholism. One of the things that happened that was really interesting is I got into a wrestling match with a five-year-old kid. No, seriously. I got into a wrestling match with a five-year-old kid, and the little bastard started to cry, and he blamed me for it, too. I have no idea why. We were given these beautiful collectible champagne glasses. I was outside. I took my $100 champagne glass and threw it against the side of the house. I'm outside Wendy's house smoking a big fat joint, and I look across the street, and who's standing across the street but some guy wearing a Broward Sheriff's Office uniform. Didn't stop me. Didn't stop me. The insanity was definitely way, way off the chart. And you know what else happened that night, guys? I drove home. And that was probably one of the stupidest decisions I could have made, but for some reason, God was watching over me and I got home safely. A week later, the woman formerly known... Hi, how are you?
Hey, good.
Good. The woman formerly known as Mrs. Berman met up with a bunch of friends of hers who said, we think Sheldon might have a problem with alcohol and drugs. You see, I don't know if you guys can relate with this. I was one of those sneak druggers. I was one of those sneak drinkers. I had all kinds of stashes in my house where I had white powdery substances and pills and little bottles here and little stuff here and crushed up this and, you know, all over the place that she never knew about. But for some reason, she never detected it. Or there's a better possibility in retrospect, she just enabled the behavior because she didn't want to deal with it. Which in retrospect, that was probably more so the case than anything else. So they meet up with her and they have this meeting where they decide it's Sheldon's intervention luncheon and the only one who's not present is the actual guy who needs the intervention. But they decide to have it with her, and the discussion is, we think Sheldon has a problem. I was always a functional alcoholic. I always worked really well. I always kept jobs, some of them for even more than 3 or 4 weeks. But I always had a job, and I always found a way to keep the lights on and keep the bills paid. So I come home from work on a Friday night, and like a good alcoholic, the first thing I do is stick my head in the freezer, pull the nice chilled bottle of tequila out, take a big long pull off of it. It's Friday night. I've earned my day. I need a drink. So I take my long pull off of my bottle of tequila. Honey, where are we going tonight? And she comes out and she says, let's go for a drive. Something was up. Something was up. So for those of you who are familiar with the area, I live west in Broward County, and at the corner of Sheridan and Dykes Road, there's a Lowe's hardware store right at the corner. We pulled out of our development, took a drive over to the Lowe's hardware store, parked in the parking lot. She looked me straight in the face and she said, either you're going to get honest with me or you need to get out of our lives. I don't need you. The children don't need you. Our friends don't need you. Our family doesn't need you. You have been living egregious lies for our entire lives, and we would be much better off without you. Now, we talk about a moment of clarity in our big book where the fog lifts for a moment and we look at ourselves retrospectively or introspectively and we say, what are we doing? How could we be so self-destructive? Yeah. And I had that moment of clarity while I was sitting in the car with her. And remember, I said to you guys, my dad was an alcoholic. I saw what an alcoholic looked like. I saw my mother go after my father with a butcher's knife. I saw my mother fly down a flight of stairs. I've seen many, many meals fly across a kitchen onto the walls. I've seen stuff as a child that a child should never, ever see. And I lived in denial for so, so long, denying the fact that I was an alcoholic because I never wanted to be like my dad was until that day that I looked in the mirror and I saw my dad. And after she sat down in the car with me and gave me that shot across the bow, for some reason, I became honest and I said to her, I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a drug addict. And I'm willing to go to any length to try and make my life better. The following day, we went to see a professional. And I sat down with the professional, and the professional did an analysis on me. She was a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, because I didn't want to go to somebody who was going to just load me up with psychotropic drugs and get me into a bigger fog than I was already in, but I wanted to find the answer to my problems. And for some reason, she felt that I didn't need to be institutionalized, that she was willing to give me a shot to try this on my own. And I had remembered 6 months earlier, I had met with my friend Bridget, and she told me that she had started going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were going out to dinner with her and her husband one night, and she was telling me about this. She said, you know, I started going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've really been a game changer for me. They really helped me understand that drinking was just a symptom of my disease, that it's a disease that centers in the mind, and there's so much more to it than just drinking. And I looked at her and I said, don't they talk about God in those meetings? She said, no, it's more spiritual than it is godly. And I have quit once again. Contempt prior to investigation, sauntered off to the bar, had another drink, and said, see you later. So after I had this meeting with the wife in the car and had the moment of clarity and everything seemed to be clicking, I remembered that conversation with Bridget and I called Bridget up and I asked her if I could come by and talk to her. And I went to her house on that Saturday afternoon after the Friday night where, you know, we had the meeting in the parking lot. And I went over to Bridget's that Saturday afternoon and we sat in her backyard and I shared some of my experience with her. I didn't have any strength or hope yet. All I had was experience. And I sat down with her in the backyard, and she put down a bottle of water just like this can right here. And she said, if that was a bottle of vodka, would you be able to not drink it? And I looked her straight in the face, and I said, no, I would have to drink it. She said, congratulations. You just completed the first half of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with just the small snippet that you heard, trust me when I tell you, gentlemen and lady, my life was definitely unmanageable. That was on Saturday afternoon. Bridget made a plan with me that on the following day, Sunday morning, I was to meet her in Weston at Starbucks at 7:15 in the morning, where we picked up coffee and we went to what was formerly the West Broward Club at 8:00 in the morning to the morning after group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in the room for my very first time, and this lovely angel named Lisa greeted me at the door. It's a diminutive little thing. She was about, 5'1", maybe 5', blonde hair, big smile, put her arms around me, gave me a big kiss on the lips, and looked me straight in the face and said, oh my God, have I been waiting for you. Little did I realize that that's exactly how Lisa greeted everybody when they walked in the door, but that was just, her way of making everybody feel at home and welcome and just her thing, man. But what a beautiful, beautiful angel. She completely diffused all of my trepidation. She took all of my fear and anxiety away. I felt comfortable. And I sat down and we started the meeting exactly like we started the meeting here. Is anybody here attending their very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I stuck my hand up in the air for the very first time and I said, my name is Sheldon and I'm an alcoholic. If I tell you, I felt that 800-pound gorilla jump off my back. I felt a freedom that I had never experienced before. I didn't realize it then, but I realize it now. That was my first real touch of the Holy Spirit entering into me, that warmth that I felt inside of me, that freedom that I had never felt before, had to be God entering into me and saying, we can do this together. Everybody in that meeting shared their experience, strength, and hope about their first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of the meeting, people came up to me, shook my hand, welcomed me. Guys gave me phone numbers and said, hey man, if you feel uncomfortable, call me and please come back again tomorrow. We need you here. Let me tell you, nobody needed me anywhere. Nobody wanted me anywhere. These people wanted me to come back again. They made me feel a part of something. They loved me when I couldn't love myself. And let me tell you, I did not like myself at all. But there was an energy in that room on that Sunday morning that was palpable. I could feel it within me, that there was something there that just drew me in and kept me there. My buddy Ralph was there, and Ralph had been a friend of mine for many, many years. We hung out together, we worked out together, we listened to music together, we attended these family functions together. It never really entered my mind why he didn't drink. I just thought he was weird. Here we are, a bunch of guys, we're all drinking like fish, we're all partying like animals, and Ralph's off on the side kind of doing his own thing, and I never really understood why. That Sunday morning, Ralph was at my first meeting. Ralph had been going to AA meetings for about 5 years already. I had no idea. And he came up to me after the meeting and he said, hey, tomorrow night I'm going to my men's meeting. I'd like you to join me. I think I gave him, in a span of about 45 seconds, I think I gave him 17 different excuses on why I couldn't go. But I went. And I walked into that meeting of East Naples Men's Group on that Monday night. And I saw a bunch of guys, just like we were before the meeting, cutting up on each other, laughing, having a grand old time, drinking coffee, telling stories about recovery, enjoying each other, loving on each other. A power in that room that I had never, ever, ever seen before. Tom, I'll call back, all right? A power in that room that I had never, ever seen before. It was amazing. It was incredible. And there was this one guy at the front of the room. He had long blonde hair and a great beard, and he spoke beautifully and he spoke eloquently. And I loved what he was talking about. And I felt him talk about it, because he talked about friends who bought drugs from him and paid in advance and shared with him. And that was my story. That was my story. And I was like, how the hell does this guy know me? But he had been sober for many, many years. And I went up to him and I said, hey, Paul, will you be my sponsor? And he looked me straight in the face and he said, are you willing to go to any length? Now that's AA code for, are you going to listen to me or are you going to give me a hard time about all my stuff? And I had no idea what he meant when he said, are you willing to go to any length? But I think it sounded like a good idea, because I said, yes, I am. And for the next 15 years, Paul was my sponsor in recovery. And he took me through the steps. And you know, it's very, very interesting. I went through my third step also. And my third step was very, very critical to me, because I really believe that that's where I came to know God. See, I grew up in a very traditional Jewish household, you know, where mommy wakes you up in the morning and says, you've got to go to school, and if you're not a good boy, God's going to punish you. That's how I grew up. But when I went through recovery, and I went through some really, really difficult times, I'm going to fast forward into year 14 of my recovery. It was probably the most precarious year of my 17 years in this deal. In year 14, after 34 years of marriage, we had decided to get divorced. I have a daughter. She has three children. I have a son. He has a child. They're bright kids. They're both attorneys. They're both married to attorneys. They're smart, smart kids. But after 34 years of marriage, the wife and I had decided to terminate our relationship. Amicably, friendly, started out that way. And Paul turned to me, he said, this is going to be the most difficult time in your recovery. There's two things that you're going to need. You're going to need a God of your understanding, and you're also going to need to stay in service. Now, why would he tell me that it's important for me to stay in service? It's very simple, because the more downtime that I have, the more time I spend between my ears thinking about everything that's going on. Idle time, right? Idle time, devil's playground, we understand that.
Sorry.
That's okay. As part of what was going on, the ex-wife decided to play the victim card, and for some reason my beautiful, bright, intelligent children decided that they thought that mom was being treated poorly. So I was always a good dad, I was always an effective dad, I was always an involved dad, yet for some reason the ex-wife decided to be a victim and the children followed into it. I received messages from both of my children basically saying, I don't want you in our life. Stay away from us. As far as we're concerned, you no longer exist. Go away. I lost contact with my daughter for 2 years. I lost contact with my son for 2 years. I didn't see my grandchildren. It got to the point where my daughter was 6 months pregnant, and I had to find out from a friend of mine that she was pregnant, because I didn't know. It was probably the most difficult time, most painful time that I ever had. I remember being on the floor of my bed, curled up in the fetal position, crying out in pain, God, if you're there, I need you now. Please give me a sign, let me know you're there. And I felt him. I felt the Holy Spirit within me. And it was different than the God that I had grown up with. It was a kind, loving, benevolent God that embraced me and lifted me up and gave me the hope and faith that I needed to get through that difficult time. And I turned my will over to him. You see, my will earned me this seat. My will got me here. The decisions that I had made prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous earned me my seat. His will, his path, that divine, beautiful, glorious path that he sets me on every single morning when I open my eyes, keeps me here. My days today start very, very differently than they ever did. I engage in this process called quiet time. I meet with a whole bunch of people on Zoom in recovery, and we read scripture to each other. About 15 minutes into the meeting, there's a quiet time of 5-minute meditation. Then we read some more scripture, and then there's a praise and worship where we listen to music, and the music is centered around the Lord. The music is centered around God, and we celebrate Him. And we celebrate our recovery. And I'll tell you, I have learned a way of life that is so beyond my wildest dreams. About a year ago, my son reached out to me after years of separation and said, I'd like to sit down and talk to you. And we met. And he shared with me some of the things that made him very uncomfortable about the divorce between me and his mother. And I asked him quite candidly, if we can work through those issues, is there a chance of me rekindling my relationship with you? And he said, it would definitely be a start. And what he was talking about with me had a financial impact on me. But you know what? I really could care less about money. Money was not important to me. What was so important to me was having that beautiful relationship with my family. I called my attorney the next morning and made the changes to the agreement between my ex-wife and I. I didn't call my son and say, hey, guess what I did? But the word got to him that it was done. And suddenly we scheduled a dinner together with me and his wife and himself. This past Saturday night, I babysat with my fiance at his house for his little, almost 1-year-old child. My daughter has been a little bit more of a challenge. My daughter reached out to me about 7 months ago and said, I know you want to see the grandchildren. I know that it's been a big strain on you, and I know it's been difficult. This isn't easy for me. But I'm willing to open the door for you and allow you to see the grandchildren. There will definitely be barriers between us, and we will definitely work through those barriers, but I think we need a starting ground. I went to her house, and I was nervous, and I was scared, and I was unsure, but I stopped before I got in the house, and I prayed. And I asked the Lord to please direct my thinking and my actions and allow His words to be my words. And I walked in the house, and for some reason my daughter walked over to me and gave me a big hug. She didn't want to let go. You know where I was on Saturday morning? I was at my grandson's baseball game. You see, my grandson, my daughter and my son-in-law were going away to California for my daughter's 35th birthday. And my daughter turned to my grandson, who will be 6 in March, and said, do you want me to have Jack's parents take you to the baseball game? And he turned to her and said, can Papa take me? Now, they live down in Coral Gables, and I live up in Sunrise, West Sunrise. And I had to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning to pick up my grandson for his baseball game. I was there at 7:45. And let me tell you, I would walk through fire for these people. This is my family. This is my children. And I'm so blessed today. I have a beautiful angel in my life, my girl Rachel. She's beautiful. She loves the Lord like I love the Lord. She loves recovery just as I do. We share recovery together. We share church together. We share our love for each other and our love for Him together. This program has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. The promises that we read in meetings have come true for me in so many, so many countless ways. I can't begin to share my testimony with you without letting you know that had it not been for that first day walking in, sticking up my hand and saying, my name is Sheldon and I'm an alcoholic, absolutely none of this would have been possible. Thank you for letting me share.